Hello and welcome to the Hive Systems podcast. I'm here with MJ DeMarco. He's the author of three spectacular books, the first of which was The Millionaire Fast Lane. It sold something ridiculous, like a million copies plus, with essentially no ad budget. It's word of mouth because people found so much value in it. And he moved on to write Unscripted, which is another spectacular book. And then his current book, The Great Rat Race Escape. It's spectacular as well, obviously, because that's why he's been invited here to talk about it. It's been recently featured on our Stairway to Wisdom, which is our membership program for great books. And so he's here to talk about that. And what I find like astonishing about great books is that years ago, we never met before. You had no idea that I even existed. And somehow, some way, this book found its way into my hands. It was the perfect book for the perfect person at the perfect time. And then, I used what I learned in this book. I applied it to my one and only life, and my life got better. Which is just spectacular. And sort of my hope for the podcast in general is that somebody who's never heard of you before is going to find this, and they're going to be inspired to pick up any one of these books themselves. And if they apply it, I think it's almost a guarantee. Like it works if they do the work, and that's really something special. So MJ, it's great to have you here on the podcast. And so A Great Rat Race Escape, it's the latest one. Tell me what's different about this one. Obviously, I think people should read the Millionaire Fast Lane first and move on. But what's different about Rat Race Escape?
Sure. All books stand on their own. You can pretty much read them in any order, but it does help to read Fast Lane first. The Great Rat Race Escape is basically a full-length novel interspersed with a nonfiction business book. So basically, there's a story there of a young couple with a baby on the way who find and discover that they've been sold a bill of goods with life, with the old go to college, save your money, get a good job. And they're just absolutely miserable in that existence. And, they're struggling in debt. And they're looking for a way out of this existence. And they're also struggling in their marriage. So there's multiple things going on. And with the story, you get to see how this couple comes to make their escape through the power of what I call fast lane entrepreneurship. And interspersed with the book are 120 business strategies and principles that you see our young couple or our young family either deploy or something that they're doing wrong. So in the book, you'll see them make mistake after mistake after mistake, and there'll be a principle or a strategy related to that. So you can actually witness, it's like you're sitting in the front row of a story of how actually somebody goes from, living a life that is pretty mediocre to living a spectacular life of dreams. You actually get to witness this firsthand in that book. And it's quite the long book because it's two books. It's the novel and it's a fiction, nonfiction strategy book. It's about 17 hours on Audible. So, and the book is, it does a nice job of wrapping up the first two books. But again, you don't need to read the first two books, but it does a nice job of wrapping it all up and kind of tying it together and seeing that in application in a real life scenario.
Excellent. Yeah, it is a long book, but it's incredibly rewarding to get through. And it's valuable way beyond anything that you'll ever pay for it. I mean, there's a big difference between price and value. The value of that book is astronomical. If it's applied, if those 120 principles are applied and you may pay $10 for it, or a really good friend who cares about you gives it to you and you apply it and your life gets better. It's just spectacular. Now, what I think of as sort of the bedrock of Millionaire Fastlane is the sense framework. At least, that's in my idea. I think that's, you can't really understand Fastlane entrepreneurship without it. So you want to just tell us what the sense framework is briefly or however long you want. What is that? How does it work?
Sure. The sense framework is is the cornerstone of my philosophy. It is a methodology for starting a business. But having a business that actually can change your life and set yourself free within just a few years, it could be 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, whatever. But basically, when you start a sense-based business, you want it to have the power to change your life, to basically make you you know, a multimillionaire, so you can enjoy financial freedom, not this mediocre existence that is now often preached on financial news websites. So the SENSE framework is an acronym for control, which is C, E, entry, need, N, T, time, and S, scale. So control basically says you want to control most aspects of your business, because if there's one entity, whether it's a person or a corporation, that can make a decision and put you out of business within one decision, you're violating control. And a good example of that is, say, a network marketing company, and you sell their products and you're doing awesome. But then say you say something wrong, or you violate one of their terms of services, and they kick you out. Boom, you just went from having a big thriving business to being out of business. Another example is you're an inventor and Walmart is your only customer. And then Walmart says, we're done, stocking your product, and boom, you're out of business. Control violations are very dominant in Amazon only businesses. Mm-hmm. If your product is some type of, gray area, and Amazon says, oh, we don't like this, you're out of, you're done. Boom. Within one person made a decision and you're out of business. So
yeah,
that is control. And control is
social media too. I mean, Facebook changes the algorithm, you're done. Like if you rely on Facebook. Yeah,
there you go. That's another example. So control is about risk mitigation and recognizing who can disrupt your business with just one decision. Now, that doesn't mean you can violate control. There's people on Amazon making fortunes, but you have to understand that Amazon is the one that holds the key, because if they cancel them, they're out of, they're in trouble. E stands for entry. Basically, when you're getting in business, there has to be a specific process in getting in business. If your business is, hey, just sign up and you're in business, or hey, just sign up to this drop shipping program, you're in business, that's not a business. You're not solving any problems. You're not solving any needs. Entry needs to be a process, not an event. Usually the longer the more troublesome the entry is, usually the better problem you're solving or the more difficult it is. So a lot of people, again, hey, I'm going to sign up and sell this affiliate program. Okay, well, you violated entry, which means you are going to struggle mightily, and you're going to have an incredible amount of competition, like intense, where you have to be the top 1% of the top 1% to make any money in that industry, because everyone's doing it, because it's so simple to do. So that's entry. Need is the most important. It like kind of frames the peak of the house. You have to provide something that is needed, that has relative value in the marketplace. And the books really go deep into need with a term I call value skew. That's a whole nother topic, but need.
I'll be asking about that.
We can get to that. Yeah, sure. And it's basically someone has to look at your offer and say, you know what? I like what they're offering here. Here's my money. And you would be amazed at how many people get into business with no need defined. They're not solving any problems. They're not providing convenience. They have no value skew. They're getting into business because it's my passion, or because I like doing this, or because I know how to do this, or all these other internal personal narratives that the market don't care about. And that's why people fail, because they're too busy looking on the inside when they should be looking on the outside. So that's N, or need. T is time, which means eventually, after you put in the grind or the effort, you must be able to diversify away from your business so it makes money 24/7. This is how you get to sleep in every day like you and not have an alarm clock. I haven't had an alarm clock set in my life for over 20 years. And once you have that set up, you can basically have your business run on autopilot. So there's particular businesses that fit into that time modality. A lot of people start businesses are only creating jobs for themselves, meaning if they do not work, they do not earn income. So if that is the case, you are violating time. You have to be able to step away and earn money while you sleep, while you're on vacation, and while you're working. Now, of course, time, there comes a certain level of putting the effort in. That usually doesn't happen within the first few months. You have to put in a certain type of effort. Like I like to say, is passive income is anything but passive. It took me like a year and a half to start really enjoying passive income. So that's T, time. And the final one is S, scale. Your product, service, or offering has to be able to be sold to many people, optimally worldwide, if not countrywide, then citywide, then statewide. Obviously, it gets lower and lower. So if you're starting a sandwich shop on the corner of Maine and Maple, you have no scale. There is not anything going to happen where one day 10,000 people show up to your little store and start buying from you. It's never going to happen. This is why the internet has created more millionaires and billionaires in the last 15 years, because this scale component is much easier met today than it was 20 years ago. So that's the sense framework in a nutshell. When you have a business that fits all those criteria, you are setting yourself up for an asymmetrical outcome potentiality within your business. And an asymmetrical outcome basically means, hey, I spent $10,000 in this business and now it is worth $15 million.
Yeah. Every part of that just flows perfectly together. It's interdependent. Like they build off each other. I mean, a company like Apple, they have pretty much every single one of those. I mean, it's just, yeah. And that's why they have such a high valuation. And I mean, in our own business with the Stairway to Wisdom, where we, you're right. Like it took me a long time to put all these book breakdowns together. I mean, I wrote 8,000 words on the Great Rat Race Escape, the key ideas and everything. But once that's up, you know, there's no marginal cost or low marginal cost of reproduction, you know, so like it doesn't cost me anything to make an additional copy. Somebody can just happen upon a landing page and sign up. I don't even have to be there. Like a bunch of times I'll wake up and see that people have signed up or more people have come, right? And scale too. I mean, it's on the internet. I mean, whoever has an internet connection can access it. And same with your books too. I mean, it's, you know, there you have like your website that, you know, anybody can access. There's no barriers. You know, it was just,
You're describing legacy value. Basically, mm-hmm. You know, we're doing this podcast right now. It's an hour out of my day, an hour out of your day. But, you know, I did a podcast with Pat Flynn, Smart Passive Income podcast or something. I did it like 12 years ago. And I don't even remember what I even said back then. I mean, I'm sure it was pretty much the same what I'm saying now because my philosophy hasn't changed. But I still, to this day, get people saying, hey, I heard you on that podcast and I bought your book or I visited your forum. And I did. That was an hour I spent 12 years ago. So the internet is definitely a powerful medium that cannot be ignored. Now, I want to clarify, I'm not saying go start an internet business. An internet is a powerful medium and a channel. In truth, most opportunities I see nowadays are in standard brick and mortar businesses, physical business, physical items, physical products that could leverage the internet and digital mediums much more effectively today than 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about all the opportunities that are available. But one of my favorite quotes from one of your books, and I forget which one. I mean, I took notes on every all of them. But you say, like, if you can't find any ideas, like any business to start, what you're basically saying is that the world is perfect and it needs nothing. You know, like there's nothing that you can improve or like find that somebody needs. I mean, that centerpiece of the sense framework. And like, that's just like there are problems that you can solve everywhere. You know,
that is my pet peeve. And I get that practically every week at the Fastlane Forum is I can't find any ideas. And it's like, oh, so you think the world is perfect? Great. I wish I lived in that world.
Before I get to my next question, for anyone who doesn't know, what's the Fastlane Forum and where can they find it?
Oh, it's the fastlaneforum.com. It's a business forum I have run Oh my God, it's been 15 years. I started it 15 years ago. I think it was right after I sold my company the second time. And I can't believe it's been around that long, but it's a discussion forum filled with fast lane entrepreneurs who are pursuing, you know, this unscripted philosophy of living. It's got over 70,000 people there. I'm there every single day. I contribute every single day. That is my social media. I do not spend a lot of time on Instagram or Facebook, because again, I'm practicing my own principles. I had a Facebook page that had 150,000 subscribers on it. And, you know, I post something on there and they show it to 12 people. So there's an example of control. And then Facebook just sent me, hey, you can build this. We have this new function called groups and this and that. And I'm like, hell no, no way. I am not wasting my time investing in a platform that can arbitrarily screw you up. Again, I worked my butt off to get 150,000 subscribers on Facebook, and now it's worthless. See, that's what I'm talking about. That's why I spend my time at the Fastlane Forum, because it's a property I control. That's not going to happen to me because I control it.
Right. No, I don't spend enough time on there, but I did visit the forum just during my research for this podcast. And just one thing that sticks out is the quality of discourse is so high. You know, like there's nobody there that's trying to tear you down or make you feel smaller. You know, they're all there to help you. And there's some very, very like extremely successful business people on there that have just insanely valuable advice for you and insights and lessons. And they give them to anyone who just happens upon the forum. And it's just like a really great resource.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'm amazed that there, just thinking about myself when I was struggling as a 20-year-old, I was like, what would I have done to have access to multimillionaire mentors? I would have done anything. And here it is sitting on my forum, freely accessible for anyone. The forum's free. And it's just like, people are just, you know, a lot of people just aren't interested in it. You know, it's like, yeah. What is wrong with you? You know, some guy just posted, hey, I just bought an $8 million warehouse. How many people do you know just bought an $8 million warehouse? Another guy owns a golf course. How many people do you know owns a golf course and is spending his days traveling the country in an RV? I mean, these are the kind of people that are there, and they contribute regularly with asking nothing in return. They're not selling $20,000 coaching courses. Neither am I. So it's just, it's a nice little pocket of the internet that is free of a lot of the bullshit, you know, like, you know, join my affiliate program, join my MLM, click this link, you know, crap like that. So it's really a nice little safe haven. And it is a lot of work, but it is worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's another business person I follow quite often. Maybe you've happened upon him, Alex Hormozi. Have you heard of him before?
Who?
Alex Hormozi. No?
It sounds familiar.
He's relatively new, but he's very much like that as well. He gives everything that he has, never asks for anything. Like he has a portfolio of companies that do like $75 million a year in revenue. And what he says all the time is like, I have nothing to sell you, you know, and he's just like, you know, here, take my best advice. He actually had a book of his own that he put zero ad budget in as well. Like he didn't spend anything on advertising. It was all word of mouth, and just, you know, thousands and thousands of people bought it and shared it. Cause it was just, he put it up for 99 cents. Like he was asking nothing. And, you know, it's crazy. And just, it's available. Like that's how I feel about books in general. I mean, you know, you want advice from a former Roman emperor on how to, you know, fight anxiety and just live a better life. You pick up.
It's amazing.
Really? Yeah. You know, you want to, you know, like figure out what education means. There's a book by, you know, Jiddu Krishnamurti or something like that. You just for free. And, you know, what's the cost of a library card? Nothing. Like the trip to the library, you know?
Yeah. And it's the world's knowledge. Whatever you want to achieve, you know, notwithstanding physical limitations, like, sure, you know, I'm short and I can't play basketball, but everything there is at your disposal if you're wanting to apply it. I mean, just looking at the books behind you, I mean, how much knowledge is just in that picture alone? And instead, you know, it's just a matter of discipline. Do you want it or do you not want it? Or do you want to know who got the rose on The Bachelor? That's pretty much what people are focused on nowadays. And I like to say the American dream is dead. American dream is not dead, or the ability to bootstrap yourself up into an incredible existence is still available. It's just the way that it has been done in the last 50 years is antiquated, and they still promote it. That's a way, and it just doesn't work anymore. And that's why I write, because I want to show people that this fantastic life that doesn't involve getting up at 6 a.m. and working 5 days a week is available to you. You just can't follow the standard rules that culture is continually promoting. This antiquated system no longer works. Job security and stability is a thing of the past. It does not work.
Yeah. I think back quite often to Nassim Taleb. I don't know if you've probably heard of him, like his idea of being anti-fragile. And like, if you're fragile, then like external events can ruin you, basically. And especially if you have like one single point of failure, like a Facebook algorithm, if that's what your business relies
control,
on.
Control, yes.
Exactly, right? It's your framework. Like, it shows up everywhere. Like, that's why it's a framework, you know? And, and want to be anti-fragile. Like, you know, if things happen, you gain from, you see, like the subtitle of his book, Gaining from Disorder. You know, so like external inputs on your system should benefit you instead of having the possibility of ruining you, right? Which is, and if you set up your business according to the SENSE framework and apply some of these things, that's exactly what you're going to get. You're going to get a fast lane business that's just going to propel you forward. I want to move on to a couple things, but I want to mention as well value skews. So a little while back, so I think that's a very important concept for business owners to understand in general. I just want you to talk about it a little bit more. What's a value skew, and how can people put that into practice? What are some best practices there?
Sure. Value skew is something you'll never learn in business school. It is my own concept. It is something I have not read anywhere else. So if you do hear it somewhere else, they've taken it from me. but it basically is this. Anytime you purchase a product, some particular value skew is what compelled you to buy. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be what people think is usually it is. It's the best price, but that's usually not what compels people to buy. It's something else. So that could be you read a story on the website that was compelling, that you identified with. It could be that the website was easier to use. It could be that there was a smiling picture of the CEO who, I don't know, just something about him and you liked it. It could be a better ingredient. It could be an ingredient that doesn't exist. And an example I use in my book is a boring package of tortilla chips. So in that scenario, the tortilla chips I bought was more expensive, but it said non-GMO on the label. So that label, non-GMO, was a value skew that compelled me to pick that over the other product, which was cheaper, that did not have that label. And then there was other packages that were more pleasingly designed. It had a better label, so there's all these factors that are in play that a consumer weighs in his head to ultimately decide, I'm going to pick that one. I'm going to give you money. So when you are starting a business, you should be focused on value skew, because any of these variables is what could compel somebody to buy from you. So, and you never know what they are because they're subjective to everyone. Certainly someone bought the other bag of tortilla chips because it was cheaper. So that's an item. So what the optimum thing to do is reverse engineer every value skew possible in what I call a value array of the industry, and see what you can do better in the consumer's eyes. So if you're doing something better in the consumer's eye and it is discernible, you improve your probability for making the sale. So this is why I say it's insane to say there's no ideas, because ideas are basically value skews. So if you have two or three value skews that you do better than the competition, you have yourself a business. And value skew again, it could be customer service. You answer the phone. You provide email support within seconds. It could be a variety of different things. And the more skew you have, the better business you have. A good example is Uber. They disrupted the taxi business. So they didn't have one or two value SKUs. They had a dozen, which is why they're now a $1 billion company and they're around the world. They got cheaper service. They got more professional drivers, you know, with the taxis with the goo on the back of the seat and all that other crap. They just basically disrupted every aspect of that industry or value SKU and created a business. So when you're getting into business, that is something you want to look at is basically say, what are we doing better than the competition? And is it discernible to the customer where it may compel them to buy from us? Now, SKU goes negatively as well. There's negative SKU. And I'm familiar with negative SKU because I've heard it for the last 10 years. I can't tell you how many times I have heard somebody say, I did not buy your book because the title sounds cheesy, or the title, it sounds like a get-rich-quick scheme. We're talking about the Millionaire Fastlane here. So that's a negative SKU. I have lost probably $1 million in sales because people have indicated they did not like that title. And incidentally, this was a problem I occurred right when the book was released. Within a month, I heard many people say that cover you have, now we're not even talking about the title anymore. I had a cover that was green and orange and had a Lamborghini on the front. It was looking back, it was pretty cheesy. And I had many people tell me, man, that cover is hideous. It's a great book, awesome book, but that cover is absolutely hideous. Ignore it. You got to buy this book. So immediately within a month, I changed the cover. And I never heard a complaint about it ever again. So if you can reduce negative SKU, you can increase your probabilities for sales. I can guarantee you, I probably wouldn't be on your podcast today, or you probably wouldn't have even read my book today if I did not fix that negative SKU 10 years ago, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
Well, yeah, it has this ripple effect over time, too. I mean, it's influenced not just the beginning of your business, but every subsequent year or like event in your business, like that beginning, like set you up for every possible success. If you stuck with that negative value SKU that you had, you never would have, you know, ever like experienced those exponential returns, which is crazy.
Sure. And here's another thing that is absolutely critical is, and this is why people fail in business. This is why people try to business and they fail. It's because they're too concerned about what they want, what they like. Mm. I loved that cover. I loved it. But everyone was coming back to me saying, hey, it sucks. So it was either, here, I'm going to stick to my ego. Oh, that's a good cover. I'm keeping it. Or I'm going to let the market dictate my path, let the customers decide where I should be going and where I shouldn't be going. There's an old saying, I would rather be rich than right. So I chose to be rich over right when it came to that cover.
Yeah, no, for sure. And what's interesting to me is that you can sort of, like, it's not easy to, like, it takes effort to provide value SKUs and sort of cognitive effort in sort of tamping down the ego to reduce these negative SKUs as well. But what you can do is you can observe what's already in the marketplace and you can see what's not being done well or at all. And you can sort of like improve on that. One thing with Stairway to Wisdom, I mean, we saw a bunch of other like book summary sites. For one thing, I mean, it's sort of like they're all sort of these sort of bland summaries. They're not really interesting or anything. But what's as well, there's just like really, really short, condensed. Like if you want to dig deeper into any of the concepts, they just give you the bare bones. And we saw a need that people wanted to go a little bit deeper. They wanted like a little bit of a longer breakdown. So like that was like a positive value SKU. And we saw these like these unethical refund policies where, you know, I would be doing a product research and, you know, we'd see reviews on these different apps and, you know, say like they charged my card 3 times and they never told me why. And, you know, I couldn't get a refund and like they told me one price, and it was like for 2 or 3 other different services. And just by eliminating that, you separate yourself from the competition and you can just observe that, you can just go out into the marketplace and see what's going on.
And here's some information that you may find helpful. I found my book, The Millionaire Fastlane, on the major book summary company. I won't name its name. And I actually read it. And I said to myself, if I never read my book and this is a summary I read, I wouldn't read my own book. It was so bad. I actually emailed them and said, remove this summary immediately. That's they didn't crazy. Even have the sense framework outlined, which is a cornerstone of my philosophy. So again, you have identified value skew. They're not doing something right. See, what I ascertained from that experience was this company is not interested in educating their viewers. They're just interested in pumping out content to say, hey, here's the summary of this book. But no one really read it. No one, someone just skimmed it and pulled out a couple of things. It's like, how do you summarize a book, but you miss the most important thing in the book? So then they did, to their credit, they did remove my summary because it was probably costing me sales. It wasn't generating any.
That's astonishing. I mean, maybe I should stop being so surprised at some of this stuff because it's everywhere. But like, that's crazy. Like, man, like, do you ever think that they're going to maybe do a better one and put it up? Or do you think they just...
I don't think so, because I've heard other people complaining about it that... it's more of a content factory where they're looking for volume. Hey, we just summarized this book. Here it is versus actually somebody, thoughtfully digging into the book and relaying decent information to the person. That's what creates the value skew for your business.
Yeah.
Because you recognize that. And a lot of people who subscribe to that website will also recognize it at some point. Mm-hmm.
People recognize value skew. I mean, absolutely. And like the very reason why I picked your book in the first place was because it was a fantastic book and I wanted more people to read it. Like my breakdowns are never a substitute for reading the whole book. They're an enticement to actually pick up the full book yourself. And you know, like this is what's so amazing about this book. You know, here's a little bit of a breakdown of these ideas. You know, maybe you want to pick it up yourself and actually, you know, have it in your hands. Like, you know, like I it's astonishing to me that you, like anyone would like hardly read anything and just be, they'd be okay with putting up work like that. That's, I don't, you know, maybe I stray too far to like perfectionism, but like still like that's astonishing. I want to ask you about it as well. And you mentioned this briefly a few minutes ago, but you have another acronym, your full acronyms, Superior Unexpected Customer Service, which sucks. And just talk about that like a little bit and like how you do that, what it looks like in your business.
Sure. Sucks, Superior Unexpected Customer Service is a value skew of customer service. Mm. And usually what it is whatever industry you're involved in, there's a standard of expectation, meaning when you call the bank, you're expecting to hear a voicemail and, you know, press one for this, press two for that, a bunch of, you know, BS. And you expect it to waste 20 minutes getting a hold of someone. Same thing with, when you call the IRS, I don't know what it is in Canada. You expect a certain expectation. So this is... throughout all industry, an example is Facebook. Have you ever tried to reach somebody at Facebook? You can't. It's impossible.
It's difficult.
Exactly. So whatever industry you're in, there's a certain standard of expectation that exists in that industry. So when you violate that expectation, you have just created value skew. Now, in my particular business, my company was known to respond to client emails within 5 minutes. And I'm talking a live person, not an autoresponder. I had a customer service rep that was in charge of this specifically. And it just absolutely impressed people. They would actually email us, say, hey, we're just checking to see if you're there. And someone was, yes, we're here. What could we do for you? And even at the forum, which I don't really operate as a business. I operate it as more of a hobby like. But even there, I do the same thing. When someone messages me something pertaining to their account, they usually get a response within the hour. And instead of, you know, just being ignored. So that's violation of an expectation of whatever is in the industry. And that's really easy to do nowadays because customer service sucks. I was just talking about this on my forum. That the trade industry, you know, electricians, plumbers, all this type of stuff, there's really a shortage of those type of tradesmen. And it's starting to become an emerging opportunity for someone who wants to apply fast lane principles to those industries. And a simple value SKU in that business, a plumber, tradesman, electrician, whatever, is to answer the damn phone or to show up on time. Right there, you have two value SKUs that are missing in an industry standard. And I can tell you, it was like that in Arizona. I recently moved to Utah. It's like that here. Nothing has changed. People don't answer their phone. They say they're going to, you know. So that's, in a nutshell, is superior unexpected customer service, or sucks. I say provide sucks, solve the sucks. Well, I forgot. Wow. I forgot how it went. But anyways, you can solve, if you solve sucks with sucks, you can provide value skew.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like such low hanging fruit that just people aren't taking advantage of it. Again, the opportunities that are available just to for value SKU and for just business ideas in general, like, it's just like unbelievable. And just like, why don't people do it? But I guess actually, that's a sort of good segue into one of the questions I was most looking forward to asking you. So you have you talk about about expected value and increasing expected value by striving for excellence rather than just striving to be sort like pretty good. And basically what you said, and you'll explain this better than I can, but I just want to ask you about it, is that, you know, if you set your expected value to good, you're going to fall a little bit short of good, or you're just going to make it. But if you set your expected value to excellence, if that's what you shoot for, even if you don't get there, you're going to get pretty damn close. And just sort of like talk about that a little bit, because I think it's important.
Sure. Like most success advice on the internet, most of it is bullshit. Most of it is wrong. Yeah. And that's why I write, because I, as a spectator of this, you know, whether it's on television, the radio, or in a book or somewhere, I so often just sit here and shake my head and go, whatever, you know. So one of those is good is good enough. You've heard that before, right? Good is good enough. Yeah. Well, good is, if you strive for good, here's what's going to happen. You will produce mediocrity. And mediocrity does not make multimillionaires. And the reason is because when you set your goal to be just good, you've just set your best case scenario. You just set your top line baseline. So it's like, I want to lose 50 pounds. Well, more than likely, you're going to probably lose 20 pounds or 30 pounds, or you're going to come up short. So when you strive for good, you know, using a bell curve, I like to say 68% of the time, you're just going to produce mediocrity. And mediocrity doesn't change lives. So what you really need to do is to strive for excellence, so your most likely outcome will be good. And then good is more likely to change your life. So, and another saying is, the enemy of good is perfect. No, the enemy of good is good. You want to strive. I'm not saying perfection. Yes, perfection is dangerous. I'm saying excellence. Do your best. Make sure you put out something that is excellent, so the majority of your customers, your clients, or whoever is the market will perceive it as good. And this is the mentality I've always approached with my work. You know, content wise, with you know, every book I've written, was to have content that was excellent and value driven. So most of my clients will think it's good. Some will think it's excellent, and very few will think it's poor. So that's the mentality I use when engaging in any project. And it has, you know, served me fabulously. So good is the enemy of good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. And it's funny. Like, it's just, you know, one of the quotes that sticks out from one of your books, again, I forget which book it's from, but you said mediocrity is the world's business model. And I mean, that's just, you know, like, you see, it's ubiquitous. Like, you see it everywhere. And sort of like another thing that sort of stuck out to me, or like that I've noticed as I go along, is that, like, when you really try, you know, you feel much better about yourself. Like, it doesn't feel good to put in a subpar performance. Like, when you actually try for it, when you go for it, when you put in like everything that you possibly have into this thing that you're doing, you go to bed, you feel great about yourself because you really gave, you know, like you spent the day like really working hard, and like hard work feels great, you know? And it's just like, people are missing out on that. Like, they don't know how great hard work actually feels, you know?
Yeah. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. You know, I think, you know, we all make mistakes. I'll give you an example. In my last book, there was a mathematical calculation. People don't know, when you write books, you're kind of in a flow. And if there's something like mathematical, you usually put like a placeholder there and you say, I'll come back to that later. And you continue to write. Well, I guess I forgot to work out that calculation. The placeholder was still there and it ended up being wrong. So that's an example of, you know, you can't be afraid to make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. We're, you know, especially with today's culture where everything is swipe, swipe, swipe. It's just little digests of nuggets of information. And that in itself is a detriment to doing good work, and which is why I don't spend a lot of time on social media. It's why I don't watch the news. It's because I'm protecting my life and my mental power and my creative fortitude.
Mm-hmm. There's another podcast you were on, Alex, the Reader's Journey podcast. And when I was researching for this one, and one of the things that he always says is like 90% of getting more reading done, which you can translate into getting anything done, is just putting your phone on silent in the other room. You know, like all these people with other, like their priorities, you know, trying to pull you into their priorities, right? And just like, if you just separate yourself from that and put yourself into a flow state, like you just mentioned, like you just get so much more done. Now, I want to ask you, like, where, like, what formed your business education yourself? Like, who did you learn from? A lot of these ideas are yours, of course, but the spark often has to come from somewhere. So who were you listening to in the beginning, and how did you sort of improve on their ideas and sort of apply them?
I'm from the school of hard knocks. A lot of this is just through trial and error that I found in my own experience. And then once I found out through my own experience, I started recognizing other people's successes fit into the same box. That's how the Fastlane framework came to pass, was studying the people who achieved wild success in a short period of time. The Fastlane sense framework was always there. So that's how I found it. But, you know, getting started way back when I was failing quite often, I got stuck in the book, Tony Robbins's Awaken the Giant Within. It's this huge old book, with a lot of mental stuff in it. And that really helped me along the way to stay motivated. You know, I haven't read that book in years, so I don't know how much relevant it is today. I'm sure it is, because it's mental. I think 90% of this game is mental, because if you're not right on the inside, those beliefs will manifest into the wrong choices. So, like, for example, someone read my book recently, and I actually had two emails from two people who read my book. One said, hey, what drop shipping program and affiliate marketing program should I join? And I'm like, you read my book? Doesn't sound like you read my book. So that's what I'm saying, is up here, he's already wrong up here. So his action into the world is going to be incorrect. The other email I got was someone read my book, and they said that, you know what, I'm going to align myself with a founder who is engaged in the sense framework, and I'm going to see what happens. Well, that was 10 years ago. And now that company is going public. It's over $1 billion valuation. And so that you have two different mindsets there of what am I going to do? And one comes to the conclusion of, hey, I'm going to do some affiliate marketing. The other comes to the conclusion is, I'm going to follow this sense framework and do something with it. And you see two wildly different results. So this game, you can't win it when this up here is all wrong. So a good portion of my material is setting this up right so you can win this outside game. You can't win the outside game until you've won the inside game.
Mm-hmm. Well, it moves from the inside outwards. I mean, like, fix external problems when you have like internal problems raging. Well, it's very difficult to do. I mean, working from the outside in, like it just doesn't, you know, doesn't work. It's like you're dealing with a complex system. You fix a complex system because there's so many different like moving parts, but like you can fix you, you know, like you can't maybe fix like your whole city or your whole country, but you can fix yourself. And like, if everyone fixed themselves, that moves outwards. And I mean, that's
sure.
As to the business that applies to just.
And the analogy I always use is someone who needs to lose weight, but refuses to change their diet. They're looking for a particular pill that's going to help them, but they still want to have 4 gallons of ice cream at night and 5 sodas. And See, that's what I'm talking about, is because you're not right up here. It doesn't matter what you're going to do out here because you refuse to change what's important. So your actions in the external world, looking for diet pills, looking for the right surgery, is not going to change a damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah. People discount the mindset, you know, stuff and thinking that it's sort of soft and you should focus on like hard business skills. And I mean, you definitely should. I mean, you should definitely like focus on those two things, but it makes such a big difference. And like, you can sort of get lost in yourself and sort of, you know, go astray there, but like that is really where the work has to be done. You know, and it all flows outwards. Now you yourself, and we'll sort of wind this down in a few minutes, but how did you react personally when you started to sort of become financially free, get sort of, you know, further along the road? Now, did you find that like you're sort of running out of interesting problems to solve, or did it sort of open up your life in a way?
Go ahead.
I mean that, like, did you find like once you're sort of out from underneath all these obligations of, you know, the stress of not being financially free, did you sort of relax a little bit and find sort of like this crisis of meaning, or did you sort of, how did you react?
It's definitely a careful balancing act because, let me tell you, I mean, sometimes I wake up in the morning and I'm just like, I can't believe this is my life. I get to do what I want, when I want, go to the store when I want, eat where I want, dine where I want, travel where I want. And sometimes it's amazing, but that existence is very comfortable. And as I like to say, comfort is an enemy to progress. So there's a balancing act there that you, I continually remind myself that I have to test my comfort zones. And, you know, one of those comfort zones is I hate doing podcasts, if you believe it or not, because I'm pretty introverted. I don't like being on center stage. So when I get the opportunity to do these, I do them because I try to, you know, convert that mentality is this is not about you. This is about you trying to help people see the light. So you switch your purpose around to conquer those things. But financial freedom is, it is, I mean, it's so amazing just to wake up and I get to write what I want. The book, The Great Rat Race Escape. I wasn't aware that there was there might be books like that, but I'm not sure if there is because I haven't found any. Writing a novel and then putting business principles into that novel is just an odd concept that I'm not sure if I gave that to a publisher, they would publish it. So because I own my own publishing company, I can do whatever I want. It gives me this creative freedom to put things out there and to touch lives and to see, you know, to see what happens. And then, being able to, my house is an absolute palace. It's, you know, it's got its own gym. It's got an indoor basketball court. I mean, it's a vacation that I don't need to leave. So, and being able to communicate this to other people through the power of my writing is incredibly fulfilling. And I try to do that with honor and integrity. I like to say that, you know, learning how to make a fortune should not cost a fortune. So I don't sell, you know, $10,000 coaching programs or $5,000 courses. You know, my books are $20 or probably cheaper than that anywhere. And everything is in there. There's nothing more to buy before, during, or after. You know, as I like to say, well, if you're so rich, why are you charging $10,000 for a program? I mean, I don't understand that. You're rich. You don't need the $10,000, do you? So that's my way of giving back. And I recommend it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, that like that's exactly what Alex Hormozi does. The guy I mentioned earlier, like he has his book, he sells for like 99 cents. He doesn't have a coaching program. He has nothing. Like he has his own business that he does. He does, you know, like everything else he just gives, right? Which is cool. I find like when people are sort of still at the beginning of their financial journey, there's a certain scarcity that they have, like so many problems and responsibilities and like debt obligations and whatnot. And it takes an awful lot of mental bandwidth to deal with that, like to have that be your life every single day. Like it's difficult. Like it's difficult to build a great business and, you know, become, you know, successful, like financially, like yourself. It's also really difficult to live like that. You know what I mean? Like it's
yeah.
Who's what?
The latest dogma in today's culture is redefining financial freedom. Yeah. There's the World Economic Forum likes to promote the you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. So now the new financial freedom is this idea that doesn't involve financial freedom anymore. It only involves time freedom. Basically, you live like a bum on the street. You own all your time, but you can't do anything. You can't go to you can't dine out. You can't drive your favorite car. You can't live in your dream house. You can't do nothing. But you can sit home and play checkers all day and you can walk the dog. And, you know, this is the new idea of financial freedom. And see, here's the thing. If you're thinking about money every single damn minute of the day, about what you can't spend, what you can't do, that is not financial freedom. That is financial enslavement. And that's the very thing I am trying to get people away from. And yet you'll see on the front page of MarketWatch and then, oh, the so-and-so retired at, you know, 35 and they live on ramen and they do nothing and they own nothing and now they're free. No, they're not free. They're slaves to money, just like they were before.
Yeah.
So I just give people caution about that's the latest dogma that is going to be promoted by the mainstream. That's why you'll see it on the front pages of financial news magazines, because it promotes a constant lack of consumption with investment into companies that provide consumption. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you're not spending your money, give all your money to Wall Street. See, you're promoting the system, whether you're consuming recklessly, you're promoting the economy, or whether you're giving every dollar you earn to Wall Street to promote those companies, you're promoting the economy. So that's the newest thing of the newest in vogue thing to promote nowadays. And it's another thing that has me going like this. But, you know, culture likes to make things, redefine things to suit their narrative.
What you just said reminded me of two excellent lines from your books. And again, I always forget which book they're from, because like the notes from all three books are meshed with each other. But the first is, you know, if you have to go through these sort of mental gymnastics in order to figure out whether you can afford it, like if you even have to ask the question, you know, can I afford this? You can't afford it. And the other one was, you know, like they're, and this is an exact quote, but it's something like, you know, mediocrity is the world's business model, of course, but like there are plenty of people and organizations out there who have financial incentives to keep you like everyone else, you know, and keep you sort of like, I mean, enslaved is sort of like a dramatic word, but it's not too far off, you know?
Yeah. And here's the thing is a lot of people are applying fast lane principles to this concept of mediocrity. And it's funny because what they teach is not what they live. So, you know, when someone is telling you, and here's a good example is we were just discussing this on the forum. If you want to read every book on personal finance about how to get rich and wealthy, here it is in a nutshell. Live frugal, save all your money, give it to Wall Street, put it in index funds and wait 40 years. If you're lucky, 20 years, 30 years, we don't know the time. But in a nutshell, right there, I just saved you from reading 526,000 books on finance, because they all say the same damn thing. And that is a prescription for mediocrity. So when I see books that are saying, oh, the secret to wealth, it's no secret. It's been out there for 50 years. And you're preaching the same damn thing that hasn't been regurgitated a million times. No, that is not the secret to wealth. That is the secret to financial mediocrity, which is why I write why I write.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's another MJ DeMarco quote. I mean, wheelchairs don't fit in the trunks of Lamborghinis, you know, like you're, you know, that's all I have to say about that. You know, that's right there. But I do think there's a certain power in not needing so much stuff, but you should be able to buy it if you want to. Like it's being, having the purchasing power to buy it if you want it, but not, you know, if you were to lose it somehow, you know, you'd still be fine. I think there's power in that. One of my favorite stories, for this is from like 2000 years ago, Alexander the Great and this philosopher Diogenes. Diogenes is like this homeless person in Athens, and he lives on the street with like nothing. He's basically today's FIRE movement. You know, he's exactly who you're talking about. But what he said was pretty cool. So Alexander the Great was a big fan of Diogenes. And so he went to visit him, and he said, he visited him in the street. He's like, he has the just tattered clothes, living on nothing. And he says, "What can I, you know, the most powerful man in the world, do for you, Diogenes?" And Diogenes says, "Well, there is something you could do. Could you move a little bit to the left? You're blocking my sun." You know, and that's like, that sort of illustrates what I mean. Like, he doesn't need anything else, but you know, you should have more purchasing power than Diogenes too. Like, you know, even if he did want what Alexander the Great had, he couldn't get it because he doesn't, you know, have, doesn't have any purchasing power, doesn't have any, sure, have any freedom, time or financial freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a balancing act. I mean, you know, certain things can destroy freedom. For me, my house was important because I'm there, you know, 23 hours a day.
Yeah.
I don't own Lamborghinis and expensive exotic cars anymore because I found that the enjoyment of them was outweighed by the hassle of owning them. You know, whether it's maintenance, repairs, a culture that, you know, views rich people as evil people. I mean, I have so many stories about when I used to own a Lamborghini, about some of the negative interactions I had in it. So, you know, I don't own those things anymore because, first of all, I'm older, and I don't really care for them anymore. But there was a certain diminishing returns to that. And but there's a certain power in, you know, for example, there's a sushi restaurant down the street, and we like eating out there practically 3-4 times a week. And it would be every day if we could, but, you know, we don't like to leave. So, and someone telling me, "Oh, you don't need that," is lying to themselves. You know, having that power to be able to do that is incredibly inspiriting and just an incredible display of freedom. And that's why I write, is because of real freedom, both time and finances. And that could be a small house or whatever or whatnot. But if you find yourself saying, "Well, I can't do X, Y, or Z because it doesn't apply to my withdrawal rates, and the stock market only made 1% this month," and this and that, you got all these mental gymnastics, these mental calculations. You're looking at some spreadsheet every damn week. That's not financial freedom. You can try, you can convince yourself it is, but it isn't. Because you're looking at that Excel spreadsheet. So that's the divergence between what I like to teach and what most others will want to teach.
Well, yeah. And I feel like, I mean, it's not as expensive to do that as most people might think. I mean, they think they need to create this billion-dollar company out of nothing in order to afford these things, but they don't really. I mean, like how much would you spend going out a week, would you say?
Yeah, and it's really not as much as you think. Mm-hmm. Like my YouTube channel, I'm going to actually do I don't want to say an expose about my living situation. Mm-hmm. So people realize the lifestyle they could have and how much money they really don't need. Like I said, my house is 13,000 square feet. It's huge. It's beautiful. But I'm going to outlay what it costs. You know, here's the maintenance, here's the upkeep. And I think when people see that, like, "Oh my God, he lives like a king," and it's not costing him millions of dollars, to live that way. And I think it will open up some eyes to being like, oh my God, you know, you don't have to be a billionaire to live like that. Not even close. So that is another thing I think people are misconstrued about, is they want to be a billionaire, but they don't really need to be a billionaire to achieve a particular lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even if you're spending like $1,000 a week going out and like buying like the best clothes that you could find and like buy, you know, Lamborghini outright and all these things, like you're still not even at $1 million. You know, like,
yeah, I have a friend that just visited me. He's got a successful business, and he was telling me he's basically my age. He's saying he can't spend his money fast enough because he makes too much of it. Mm-hmm. And that's the financial freedom I'm talking about. So he does a lot of donations. He gives away to a lot of charity. You know, whenever he wants something, he buys it. He drives a six figure car. You know, so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about is. You can't spend it quick enough. And it's a great way, especially when you're getting older. You mentioned the book Die with Zero. Mm-hmm. That does a fantastic job of explaining this type of balancing act that as you start to get older, you want to start be more of a spender than a saver, because certain experiences that as you get older are not the same as when you are younger.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, from that book, I mean, we actually covered Die with Zero in Stairway to Wisdom, same as Great Rat Race Escape. And what he says is like, when you invest in your health, like it improves like that current experience, and it improves the quality of every subsequent experience that you have, you know. And like, if you reach, you know, the age of 40 and your knees are so bad because you can only afford like, you know, this crap food for the last 20 years and your health is shit. And like, you're never going to like, there comes a point when you're not going to be able to come back from that, you know? And like, if you sort of just sabotage yourself in that way, there's going to be a point when you're no longer able to come back from that. And it's just going to degrade every situation or every experience that you have from then on. And like,
that book, Die with Zero, was the only book I've ever read that discussed the time value of time. Mm-hmm. Meaning your youthful free time is far more valuable than your older free time, because things you can do when you're young are not the same as they're older. And the example I just gave was a YouTube video I did. Was I have terrible joint problems from various injuries, accidents from my youth. So I just moved to a place that is one of the skiing capitals of the world. And I don't know how to ski. And here's the thing is, I don't know if I can learn how to ski because my ankles and joints and stuff are so screwed up from various surgeries and accidents and whatnot. So me learning how to ski at 25 years old is a lot different than me learning how to ski at 50 years old. And none of these movements, the fire movement, all this other stuff that tells you about waiting, you know, deprive yourself of these life experiences young so you can enjoy them when you're old, is the most ridiculous concept I've ever heard. And people are doing it and they're gobbling that crap up like there's no tomorrow. I'm telling you.
It is what it is. Like, it's a tragedy. Like, just having, like, anybody wasting their life, it is a tragedy.
Yes. So that book does a great job of, you know, the fine balancing act between saving and deploying money for experiences and financial freedom. I don't agree with everything in it, but it did a good job enough that I recommend it to this day. So,
Well, Bill Perkins is a friend of Dan Bilzerian. And what Dan said in his book is like, you know, money can remove sources of unhappiness, you know, but, you know, it's sort of like it sort of solves certain problems and it sort of frees up the mental bandwidth so you can sort of find out what does mean more, like the bigger problems, like the money or the problems that money can't solve, you know.
Yeah. And again, if anyone tells you money can't buy happiness, they're bullshit liars.
Exactly. Okay. Right. Exactly. to an extent,
my dog, German Shepherd, 4 years ago, he needed surgery on both his legs. Both his ACLs were blew out, couldn't walk, couldn't even get up to go pee. Now, if I didn't have the money to get two surgeries on his legs, which I think it was about $12,000 to $20,000. I can't remember the cost. I would have had to put him down because he couldn't go to the bathroom anymore. But I was able to get these surgeries done. And I remember thinking afterwards, he's with us to this day still, thinking, people, I'm so sick of people. Oh, money can buy figments of happiness, because this dog has made me happy for the last 4 years, and he wouldn't be here if it wasn't for money. So beware. Again, this is all, if you want to live a conventional life, stop following, conventional people giving conventional, I'm screwing that up, but basically, conventional wisdom from conventional people living conventional lives is going to get you a conventional life.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'll wind this down, and we've been talking for quite a while now, but this is probably just an hour so well spent for anyone just happening upon this. Like, where else are you going to find this? And you're going to find lots of other people sort of not telling you like what we've been talking about. And it's like, it's not a secret, but so many people are telling you like just myths, mistruths and half truths and sort of, you know, like things that, you know, that don't work. And it's just like people are, I feel like people would be really lucky to happen upon your books and this podcast, you know, like I was, you know. One of my last questions, and at what point do you think that kids should receive a financial education?
The sooner the better.
Yeah.
Because
I guess I'm worried that like teachers themselves, they wouldn't really understand, like they wouldn't be able to teach it really. Like they wouldn't be qualified to teach.
Well, that's the problem, because what they're going to get is they're going to get the mainstream narrative finance, which is go to college, no matter the cost, even if it costs you $100,000 in student loans for that philosophy degree, you need to go to college.
Yeah.
And then you got to get a good job. See, what it is, they're still promoting this antiquated template for the American dream or for success. And it simply doesn't work anymore. You can have a degree in engineering, which is a fine degree, but you are not guaranteed any job. You're not guaranteed any good salary. You're not guaranteed job stability. That system no longer works, which is why you have to be an entrepreneur. So that's the problem with, educating young people, is they're going to get the mediocrity narrative. And that tells you how to be a good slave in the system. So it's really up to the parents. Of course, leading by example. My stepson came from the, be a slave type of educational mentality. And now he's got much bigger dreams and realize there's so much more out there if he applies himself in the right system. So that's what my work is about, is disavowing the old system and learning to adopt a new system and seeing the amazing things you can accomplish once you adopt that new system, and do it in 5 years, 4, 7 years, 10 years, whatever, something that's not going to take 30 or 40.
Exactly. And much faster with the internet. And like, I think a big part of that is being around people who have done it and people that you can point to and like, he did that, like she did that, he accomplished that, like they have done this already. This is what they have done. Your path's going to be a little bit different. One of the things that you say is that like starting a business is going to be one of the hardest things that you ever do. And growing that business is going to be like the second hardest thing that you ever do, but it's possible. People have done it. You just need the right framework, the right path to follow, and sort of ignore or take what you can from other, financial philosophies here and there, what's useful, but disregard the vast majority of it, unless you want the same results as the majority. So
sure.
I think, we're going to wrap this up, but I just want to ask if there's anything else that you want to mention, what you're involved with now, what your next steps are. Do you think, this last book was half fiction? Do you think you might write an entirely fiction book in a different direction, like non-business related? What's coming up for you?
Yes, that's definitely on my bucket list. I'd like to write a fiction story, kind of emblematic to like The Alchemist, something like that.
Oh yeah. I love that.
I do have another, also another nonfiction book that is really narrowly defined, that will not change financial lives, but will just save lives, period. So that one I'm excited about. Yes. You know, and that's part of the reason why I can do what I do. I love to write. I can follow my passion and not have to worry about money. And that is the ultimate dream I can ask for anybody. Because oftentimes following passion does not pay bills. It does not, you know, it does not lead to markets that have value skew opportunities. So that's on my, that's what I'm doing. I manage the Fastlane Forum pretty much every day. That's kind of a love-hate relationship there. So that's what's going on. Thanks for having me.
I'm on your text message network as well. I get the text message updates from you. That's actually how I learned of one of the books that you recommended recently, The Untethered Soul. How many people get those text message updates?
I mean, how many are on board with that?
Yeah.
It's close to 4,000.
Nice. Okay, sweet. Yeah. I mean, I always open them. I mean, it's like they're short. You know, it takes me just a few minutes to read something positive in my day, you know, that I'm better off knowing. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's called the Unscripted Network. That is at the moment, that is free. So feel free to join that. That's you can either find that on Telegram under the Unscripted Network, or you can send me a text message. I don't know what the number is. I don't have it with me, but it's basically... I'll send you two or three texts a week, short little blurbs about life and business. I don't sell shit on there. You know, hey, visit this new program. Hey, do this. Hey, so, you know, I don't do any of that, which is what a lot of people use that for. But I do not do that.
Right. Excellent. Yeah. I mean, like I said before, I mean, I almost say it too many times. I'm sure like people will stop believing me if I keep saying it. But I mean, your books are fantastic. I mean, all three of them, like I took detailed notes and I applied them and my life got better, you know, like I said, so highly recommend them. And definitely just, you know, to everyone listening, check out Millionaire Fastlane first, I would say, but like you said, they're not in any sort of sequence. Nonetheless, you can start with Rat Race or even Unscripted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Highly recommend that everyone do so. And thank you, MJ, for giving up an hour and a little bit more of your day. I appreciate it immensely.
Hey, it's no problem. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I appreciate you having me.
Me too. Cheers.